What a gorgeous day, huh? Lynn was just sitting out on the porch and she said she actually watched a tulip start to open. It's like it just was opening right there. So the poem that we're reading at night is by Rainier Marie Rilke. And he was born in Prague in 1876 or 75, I think, and lived in Paris a good portion of his life. But he also spent a number of years in the Duina castle of a princess, Princess Marie, long name, and he was said not to be a poet, but to be poetry itself. And he has a lot of different works out and available and translated by different people. And he lived to be 51 years old. So he died in 1926. That's just a little bit about him. He never felt like he belonged anywhere. He felt like he was in exile his whole life. He didn't like Prague. His parents were of German ancestry, but he didn't claim that either. And even in Paris, he found Paris somewhat insufferable. So he always never quite felt like he belonged anywhere. And yet out of that, you know, difficulty, came that incredibly beautiful, beautiful poetry. So we are involved in heart work this week. Letting the world in each moment, over and over again, so that the earth can rise within us invisible, the birds, the frogs, the apple blossoms. It is the us that is invisible, not the bird, the frog, or the blossom. The earth rises within us invisible, and we are the ones that are invisible. With awareness and attention, it's just bird. It's just apple blossom. Just tulip opening. And I call this heart work. It's a kind of listening and a kind of letting go. And inherent in listening from the heart is a question. And I think that's what makes us human. The ability to question, to have doubt. It's the very core of our significance as human beings in the world. To be open in wonder, and through that opening, where we still our hearts and minds in the question, we enter the mystery. Where do I come from? Where am I going? Who am I? So 2,000 years ago, the Buddha gave an answer. He said, not being, not non-being, not self, not no self. And then about 1,000 years ago, Dogen also gave an answer. The 12th century Zen master Dogen said, to practice the way is to study the self. To study the self is to know the self. To know the self, body and mind fall away. All things in the universe come forth and confirm that self. And now in our time, we revisit this task anew. It's what we're doing here this week, and it might seem impossible, like hard work. But I found a lovely Wendell Berry poem called Hard Work that goes like this. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. So in the Buddha's first teaching that he gave after he woke up, saw the morning star, and said, now I understand. And he went to find his five companions to explain to them, to talk with them. And what he said was, dukkha, discomfort, unease, suffering, has been comprehended, has been seen. In the arising of dukkha, it is let go of. And in the letting go of dukkha, we see it ceases. And that is the action of cultivating the path, the Buddha way. So the first teaching was about seeing through suffering and unease to comprehending it, and in that comprehension, being able to let go. And when we've let go, we can avoid responding to the world and our situation by reaction, and instead have a way to step forth and act from sati, with attention, with compassion, which is a true way we are given to offer ease in the midst of unease, to offer comfort in the midst of discomfort. And when we take it upon ourselves to sit on the cushion, we take this practice upon ourselves to walk in this way. But today I'd like to take up the second teaching of the Buddha, which was the teaching on not self. In the Tao Te Ching, we read that the 10,000 things are born of being, and being is born of non-being. So what does the Buddha have to say about this? So the Buddha wrote about non-self, no self, in many places throughout the sutras. But specifically, he spent a lot of time with this teaching in this, it was recorded in the Samyutta Nikaya, or the Connected Discourses. This morning we read about the five aggregates. Aggregate is like a collection that comes together as a whole. It's the skandhas, the five skandhas. Sometimes it's translated as the five bundles. And it's form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And we've run into this in the Heart Sutra also. It's a very common expression in Buddhist teachings. Thay talks about the five aggregates as separate rivers that are always flowing. That if we look at form, if we look at our feelings, if we look at perceptions, they're always moving. There's nothing solid to hold on to. And the Buddha said that we can look at these things independently. But rather, I see them more as like a braided stream. It's like a single river of experience. Before thought of self and other, it's just the song of the sparrow outside. And with no thought of, I hear the song, I hear the singing. It's before subject and object. And this is what we are encountering in our meditation. But let's look at these five aggregates individually, as they are the basis of our life experience. You know, body or form, we touch into a real true meditation of body or form each morning when we recite the five remembrances. It's a meditation on the body. You know, when we think about our body, we think of ourselves as a body. We're not the same body that we are as a baby, that we were born with. But we are the same too. It is the same body. And yet, it's not the same body. And the same is true at any point that we look at our body. It's completely different. And included in looking at body is, you know, our senses is what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch in each moment. And that's our body too. And the second skanda is feeling. And what that is, what does anything feel like? If, you know, our response always, well, this feels good, this feels bad, or neither good nor bad, we just sort of feel indifferent to it. And it tells us, you know, about our experience, you know, how we relate to our experience and how it feels to us. And you know, we identify it, you know, as something solid. Yeah, I don't like this. Oh, I like this. The third skanda is perception. And that's how we then comprehend or understand what we see and what we sense. It's like based on our associations. And it's like, what does our experience mean to us? And how are we going to respond to what we experience? So, for example, when we step outside and it's pouring down rain and it's cold, we immediately think, we identify that it's cold and it's unpleasant and where's my coat, and a whole bunch of associations arise with that experience. And we respond to that experience in that way based on our associations with wet or cold. I have some friends who recently moved to the Pacific Northwest from a very sunny place. And this year was one of the rainiest years in history. And they have been very unhappy. Their perception is the Pacific Northwest is just gray and soggy and foggy and depressing. That's their perception. So it's like how we, you know, we compare things, you know, to the past and how we experience them in the, it's like the context for our experience. And then the fourth of the skanda is mental factors. It's like, that's like our habit energy, you know, our habitual way of responding, our habitual behavior. That they have done research on our brains. It's, you know, says there are certain electrical neuronal pathways that get reinforced by particular thoughts or behaviors, and if we respond and think to about something in the same way over and over again, that becomes a pathway that gets well developed in our brain, and then we respond out of that particular pathway. I think we're a lot more than just, you know, the material reaction of our chemicals in our brain and our neurons. But nevertheless, there is some indication that certainly is at work in a physical way. You know, if someone is the oldest child in a family and they are always responsible to make sure everybody's in line and got their hands washed and their face washed before dinner, and they're used to being in charge. It's very difficult to go into a situation where all of they are no longer in charge, and bit by bit they will find ways to be in charge of the situation. And if they're not in charge, they're going to feel really uncomfortable because that particular pathway is being blocked. Dhammadina, who is one of the earliest nuns in the Buddha's tradition, very famous nun, she's quoted in the sutra as saying that she called mental factors inclinations, and saying that there were three inclinations. One was the body's inclination, which is to breathe in and to breathe out. You know, we can't stop that. We can't stop breathing in or breathing out. And that our mind's energy is, its inclination is to constantly feel and perceive in a particular way. Tai calls it habit energy. And that we have an inclination of speech, which is the habit of sharing our thoughts out loud. All of these things get a little frustrated by our practice. And consciousness then is really amorphous in a way, but it's considered to be the experience of all the other four skandhas. You cannot separate consciousness from perception, from thinking, from feeling, from body. They all give rise to consciousness. So why is this important? Why is it important to, why does the Buddha go to all the trouble of defining these particular rivers of experience, rivers that define our way of experiencing? Because in looking at these, we can study the self. You know, we don't really have a lot of control over life. We think we do, but I mean, we didn't have control over being born. We don't have control over whether we get sick or not. We don't have any control or knowledge of how we're going to die or when that's going to happen. We don't have control over people around us, try as we might. We don't have control over our lives. I mean, when we look at our lives, who would have ever guessed? When you look at your particular individual life, who would have ever guessed that it has happened the way it has happened? That it has evolved the way it has evolved? That what has happened in your life has happened in your life? I mean, we couldn't imagine any of it. But we think we're sort of in control and we're making things happen. And I actually really like what John Lennon said, is life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. So we have all these things we're doing to make our life happen. And something totally else different is happening. It's just like totally different. It's like experience is what happens to us. And yet, you know, that's at odds with what we think. You know, our belief in a self is a conviction that we are in control of our lives and what happens to us. You know, in terms of our feelings, well, we really like this person and we can always count on them to be just the way we like them to be. But one day, it turns out they ignore us, and then we don't like them at all. In fact, we're really pissed at them. We don't want anything more to do with them. And this basic difficulty is what we keep running into over and over and over again when we think about ourselves and the world. It really isn't the way it is. And the Buddha said, you know, we want the world to be permanent. We think the world is permanent. We think the way we are right now, this moment, is the way it is. This is it. And we want our lives to be satisfactory. We want comfort and ease. And everything in our lives, we want it to be the way we want it to be. We want it to be intrinsically ours. And the Buddha calls these the three fires. We want things to be the way that we want them to be. We want ourselves to be the way we think we should be. Aversion. When something isn't the way we think it should be, when we aren't the way we want to be, when our life isn't what we want it to be, when someone treats us in a way we don't want to be treated. And self-interest. It is, at some level, all about me and mine. And when it's not this way, we get hurt. We get disillusioned. We get angry. And we react out of that in the world. We live out of that, that constant struggle. So this is dukkha. This is the basis of dukkha in life. And our first task is to see it, to comprehend it. You know, most of the time we go through life just kind of getting through the day, taking each particular task of our daily life one at a time, one followed by the other, sometimes multitasking, doing this and this and this and this. And, you know, we really don't stop to think about how we feel or what we're thinking about too much, or question why we feel the way we do. You know, we it's like kind of being on automatic pilot. You know, when somebody asks us how are you, we say, I'm fine, thanks. It's like the polite conventions. We act and we respond as the way we were taught to, the way we think we're supposed to. But when we practice meditation, we bring our attention to our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, and our reactions. And it's not even like we need to put our attention there, because as we are breathing in and breathing out, our attention goes to what we're thinking and what we're feeling. We, you know, embody the practice of breathing in and breathing out consciously. And as we begin to quiet our minds and get more concentrated, then naturally we find, you know, the unresolved difficulties of our life coming up. Something might happen, we feel hurt or pissed, and it comes and it visits us. And if we are able to sit very still and concentrated, what is stimulated will be there within us. I think that, you know, when we first sit down, you know, we really have all these ways of distracting ourselves, which are pretty much, I think, the patterns of the way we distract ourselves in our daily lives. So, you know, fantasies or sleepiness or just, but, you know, it's, again, you know, it's like having that real question then gives us energy to kind of cut through that habitual distraction and to really take ourselves in hand and sit and listen and let whatever comes be there. It's not an intention of finding something or working on something or fixing something. And I think this is a really important distinction, because what I see happening a lot in the modern reiteration of Buddhist practice is a kind of psychology of we come to a cushion. In fact, there I've gone to sanghas where before I arrived they would hand out a questionnaire saying, what is your intention in this retreat? What do you want to resolve? And you know, which is, again, it's an emphasis on, you know, working something out. You know, we're here to figure something, figure out some problem in our lives, or, you know, understand something about our psychology. But Buddhist practice is much deeper than that. From that quiet, still, focused place, what needs our attention will come sit with us. And I always think it's not too good to try to look directly at it, but let it kind of sit beside us. And breathe in and breathe out until we feel really stable and really solid. It's a kind of embodied attention. You know, when we recite the meal gathas before we eat, there's one that says, my body is mindfulness itself, calm and at ease, free from distraction. And that embodied attention includes everything. It doesn't exclude anything. This is the flesh and bones of Dharma practice. In Pali, it's called yoniso. I'm not sure the pronunciation. But it's very interesting because it comes from the word for womb, yoni. It is a kind of a caring and nurturing attention. And it, you know, it's like when a woman is pregnant, you know, she's very concentrated. Her attention is very concentrated. Something really important is happening inside her that always is present, always there. She's always listening. And it's like that when something has caught our attention, a feeling, a perception, a mental inclination. We don't get involved in it. I mean, it's like a woman when she's pregnant, she doesn't know the baby. She doesn't really know what that baby's going to look like, what its sex is, doesn't know much about it at all. But still she pays very close attention, a very kind of nurturing, caring attention. And it's our tendency, of course, when we're caught in a feeling or a perception, is that, you know, well, that person really did do that, and they really did do that to me, and it really did hurt me, and I have every reason to be pissed off and never want to have anything to do with them again. You know, it's, I know I think, I feel, I see, I understand. You know, it's all about then that self, that elusive self. And it's being caught there that we experience dukkha. And there is no way to think our way through this or think our way out of it. We see it. We see it arising. And we let go. And because most dukkha is pretty fixated, pretty patterned, it'll come back again and again and again. And we let go again and again and again. But it's not a letting go that pushes away or tries to change or make it different. It's a kind of letting go that is filled with attention and caring, a kind of nurturing. And in the practice of that, at some point, and sometimes it takes a long time and sometimes it happens right away, we see the ceasing of the dukkha, the ceasing of the reaction to the suffering that we're holding on to. It lets go of us. And when it lets go, you know, it's like there's a knowing inside of us, a deep knowing of what to do, how to act, and how to respond. When we are still caught, inevitably our reaction will create more dukkha. And then that is its own beauty, because we have a new dukkha to look at, to comprehend. So, I mean, it's not awful when we make a mistake. It's not awful. I mean, it feels awful when people are pissed at us and all of that, but just another opportunity. And to look. So it's really important that, you know, like we kind of see how this is in our own lives, and how it works. The deep freedom that arises. And you know, as we continue to practice, I always like to say our heart finds the way. Our heart knows, starts to know the way to, through that dukkha, that disease, that discomfort. But it is always moment by moment. It is always situational. It's never, I don't believe, absolute. But the Buddha called this not self. Not no self. I mean, clearly there's a self, right? Clearly you are there and I am here. The trees are out there. Clearly. And in that deep letting go, though, when we know the self, we let go of all the attachment to the feelings, the perceptions, to me and mine. And inevitably, the response is the noble pathway, expressing the compassion of that freedom. It might be, and I hate to use the word compassion, because we have all these ideas about what compassion is. And compassion, as all of our response, needs to be based on the situation right in front of us. If a child is about ready to run in front of a moving car, it is compassion to grab that child so quickly that maybe you bruise its arms. That is compassion. So it's good not to have an idea. In fact, the Buddha says, Let go of all your ideas. Let go of all your concepts. You know, the Buddha is not really so interested in what we are, what people are, but in what people can do. And that is how we respond to the world anew in each moment. And it's creative and it's appropriate. And, you know, it's inevitable that we look at, you know, what's the world around us and we ask, why is there so much suffering? And, you know, the suffering is our vehicle for freedom. That's what the Buddha said. And it doesn't matter if it's my suffering or your suffering. It doesn't matter if it's my self-doubt or your pissiness. It doesn't matter where the suffering is. You know, a sculptor knows that with a block, having a block of marble is a really difficult media to work with. You know, it's really hard, it's solid, it's resistant. Takes a great deal of effort to change it or to get anything to arise out of it. But also every sculptor knows that you can do nothing with a cloud. Creation needs resistance. A bird or an airplane can fly through free space, but its motion depends on the pressure on its wings against the air. Even if you can't see the air, even if you can't know it, it's there and it's absolutely necessary. The world we live in is absolutely necessary for us to develop completely. And that's all the Buddha is interested in, that we develop completely. That we face the rigidity, the solidity, the permanence of me and mine, of moral adversity, in order for us to truly realize our deepest humanity. And we don't stop. And we don't get caught in our ideas about what it is. Someone said to me yesterday that, you know, what had arisen for them was thinking about the suffering of the refugees from Syria. And they realized that they couldn't know what it was like for them. But we all do know that in the depths of deepest suffering, with awareness, the world is more alive for us. I had a dear friend who died about 4 or 5 years ago. And she said when she got diagnosed with lung cancer that had metastasized to her bones. And she said when she got that diagnosis, it was like the world all of a sudden came alive for her. Each moment, the colors were so bright. The music she listened to was more beautiful. The people she loved were treasured all the more. Every moment was so precious. Our heart is broken open by the world. And our practice is to let that happen and not get caught in it, not push it away, and also not to chase after it. As we continue to practice, we see in the dukkha is the letting go, and in the letting go is the ceasing of reactivity. And it's from that place we can act in a way that honors our ancient inheritance. that inheritance, that heritage that is greater than ourselves. And there's no end to it, personally or in the world. Yeah, Wendell Berry said, when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. And that journey is a pilgrimage. In Buddhist iconography, they say that in the center of the universe there is a mountain called Mount Meru. In the Tibetan tradition, I think they call it Mount Kailash. And on pilgrimage to Mount Kailash, you walk for days and days before you even reach the path that goes around the mountain. And even still, that path begins circumambulating. And even though the mountain is not yet visible, you are walking round and round that mountain. And it might feel like it's suffering, that mountain. Because all you see are vast plains and barren hills. You know, at times there might be other pilgrims, but you can't take refuge in them. You have to go on your own. It's helpful to know there's other pilgrims, other people walking the same way. But you have to walk on your own. The Buddha said you really can't even follow anyone else. You have to do your own heart work. You have to take your own steps. And though it's really barren, and you don't know where the path is, you let go and take the next step. And you go and you go, and finally you let go of ever seeing the mountain. You have to let go of your idea of pilgrimage, and you have to let go of the idea of traveling. You have to let go of the idea of the pilgrim as well. And it's only then that the luminous mountain appears. And that luminosity is our ancient inheritance. Dogen said, to walk the way is to study the self. To study the self is to know the self. To know the self, body and mind fall away. And the luminous mountain appears. He says, all things in the universe come forth and confirm us. And that's when our life really begins, about living true to that vision of the luminous mountain. For the mountain is us, bright, shining, illuminated, like the universe that we are part of, like the universe that we can never be separate from, not by birth, not by death, no identity at all. And we step forth as this self, in this body, in this moment, no self at all.